And I had such a strong point.
I'm telling you. I felt bad for you.
Oh, man.
You pulled the rug out from under you.
I just got bodied so bad, man.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of American Daisies. I'm going to try this voice. No, I can't do it. I can't do it at all. I'm Arjun.
I'm still being pleasant. I'm Akash.
So there's a funny story. We did this interview a year ago, or maybe a little bit longer than that, and we had called a title, we had everything, but we unfortunately had messed up the technical stuff and lost all the audio, which made me very sad because it was such a fun conversation with the woman we have today, Louise Keshavaya.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for having me here.
She is a part of my representation team. So if I'm being extra nice to her, that's why.
She's still going to take 10%.
Exactly.
I pay you to be mean to you. That's the way I look at it. You're my agent, you better get ready.
Why is he winking at me right now?
But yeah, we wanted to, there's a few reasons that we were excited to have you on and a fun conversation, mainly about how you were an evil genius was what the big theme of it was last time.
And
we'll see if that comes up again this time. But... you know, I met you four years ago. You were at that point an assistant to who was one of my agents, Nick Collins, shouts. Mm-hmm. Even at that moment, you had a very strong affinity towards South Asians. You mm-hmm. felt a strong, I don't know. Would
kinship?
You? Yeah, you know? Kinship. You from the jump really wanted to support South Asian actors, actresses, writers.
So I think, you know, one of the reasons that I'm on, as we talked about, is because I am married to a South Asian man. And because of that, I think that, you know, when you're married to someone, when you're in a close relationship with someone, you really get to know them in a lot of ways. And so because I've connected to the culture and been exposed to the culture and, you know, I consider my in-laws my family. And so when you meet another South Asian, for me, it was almost like, oh, hey, I know about your culture. I know, I understand some of the stories of your background. And I know, especially in entertainment, and I know how hard it is. And I know how, you know, and you guys talk about this a lot in terms of how you're pigeonholed and the stereotypes and from everything to how to say your name. And for me, it's like, I can say your name right. Like, let's just start there. So I feel that when I come across a South Asian actor, I want to be like, okay, I'm going to support you, champion you, et cetera.
Well, we will get to your relationship. Yeah. And that's an exciting part to talk about. But I do want to ask you this. You also a fan of the podcast, which I love, which is very sweet of you. But you've heard us talk about and the conversations around the obstacles that are placed in front of South Asian. And we usually speak more specifically to South Asian men. I would love to hear from, you know, an agent perspective. You would have a different perspective. Because you have the conversations with the casting directors. You have the conversation with directors and producers and stuff. I would love to hear, you know, do you agree with some of those obstacles what insight can you bring to that conversation?
First of all, absolutely. Those obstacles 100% exist. What's nice is that it's changing. It's changing in an incremental way that can be described in a little bit as tokenism sometimes but now there's just more of it. Okay. Now.
Well, what do you mean that there's now more of it? What do you
like? I mean that it's not just there's the token. It's not just that there's the token black friend, but there's the token black friend plus also the authority figure. You know, and especially with regards to South Asians, you know, in Aziz Ansari's show, Master of None, it's that there can't be two. You know, there can be one Indian guy, which is great, but there can't be two. So in that way, I do think that the struggles that you guys talk about are real. And yet the tone of that is shifting. There is a push for diversity, both on a business level and on a, you know, just on a moral level, especially with, you know, Queen Shonda and everything like that. But all hail, right?
Shouts.
I'm not saying nothing bad about her.
I mean, she's great.
So
That's all I added.
I'm trying to.
That's all I added. She's great.
Yeah, sure. We talk about her all the time. I'm trying to remember your earlier question. So
my question was like, what? Because I'm, you know, I sit here and I think that, you know, when I say, I think it's everyone's responsibility. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think that oftentimes we talk about it from a casting standpoint.
Right.
And I think that when I think about casting directors, I think like oftentimes, you know, based on the structure, and we were just talking before we started about how silly and inefficient pilot season is, mm-hmm. but that structure doesn't allow casting directors to move outside of what is their safe community of
right.
people to bring in. And so unless you've already been in that network and already have that access, right. how do other people break in?
Here's what I will say in terms of the struggles that actors face. The one thing that is a struggle that you all face that everyone faces is trying to not be typecast, trying to not, when you're an actor, you want to play all different kinds of roles and you don't want to just go out for the one thing. And every single actor gets tired of whatever box that they're put in. Every single one. I mean, there are very few people that are like, okay, I play the best friend and I'm just going to play the best friend and make all the money. And I don't care if I'm ever a leading person or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to trivialize or diminish the stereotypes and the kind of limitations that are placed on actors of color and specifically South Asian actors, especially because a lot of times it, even educating into what South Asian even is can be a struggle. I mean, sometimes I'll even...
Really?
Well... Yes and no. I'm kind of joking, but I will be on the phone with someone. They say, we want someone Asian American, and I will bring up someone Indian, and they'll be like, no, we want Asian.
The Chinese ones.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, you're going to say Oriental to me, aren't you? I dare you. I dare you to say Oriental to me now.
Yo,
you know, like
PC police four guard right here.
But I'm like, okay, but you know that India is in Asia, right? What do you mean by that? And I actually find that more happens with women than it does with men. Like when it says Asian for men, they're open to more Indian. But with women, it's a very specific, like they want the exotic, hot, you know, stereotype of whatever an East Asian woman
is. You know what's interesting is in, I think I might have said this on the podcast, in England, I went there and we are Asian.
Yes.
And then they always kept like, I remember they kept laughing about the fact that like, oh, you guys don't call yourselves Asian. You call yourselves Indian like it's something different, blah, blah, blah. You don't understand. And I was like, all right, well, what do you call people from like Korea or Japan yeah. or China? And they go, oh, we just call them all Chinese. And I was like, all right, well, you're not better really? Than us, first of all. Second of all, it's just their first Asians were probably us.
Yeah. Right.
We came over there a long time ago. Right. The first Asians in America were the ones that they made build the railroads.
Yeah.
So we are two people from the same continent who look completely different. Like if Ireland was white people and then some other European country right next to it, I don't know a map well enough to tell you which one is next to it, was like England is all black people. It'd be like, all right, well, European, you can't just look at a guy and say, hey, that's European. Right. So how do you, South Asian, North Asian? Like what is the distinction?
Well, I mean, it's a concept of Western power that we even talk about Asia and Europe as separate things. They are all one continent. There's no divide between Europe and Asia. There's no body of water. There's nothing right. that separates those lands.
Russia's in both.
Eurasia. I mean, you know, and there's been movements for Eurasia to be the title of the continent. But I think it's just why bother?
Well, it also just like proves race is such a social construct. Not that it doesn't matter within the within talking about it in terms of racism, things like that. And I'm not saying that like, oh, everybody looks the same and I only see the human race. It's like, I'm not that white person, you know? But I mean,
God,
it
you are
as
so good at navigating these waters. It's astounding. I have never seen especially not a white person, just walk through just slide swipe, what is the word? Walk past every landmine and just miss all of them. Because we're waiting for white people to say the wrong thing and then it's just bang, get them. And she's just like, nah, sidestep, that's the one. Bang, bang, bang.
Do you have any alcohol here? Maybe we can just have me just say something stupid.
This is part of the evil genius.
Yeah, I'm seeing that.
Also, I've been trained very well, you know? Trained well.
I see that.
Yeah.
I see that.
Well, so, I would love to hear, actually, because, you know, again, you work with South Asians on men and women, and I, you know, my perspective, not to say that you can speak for them, but you could give insight into their experience and how it's different from South Asian men. You already touched on it a little bit that, like, mm-hmm. there's a difference in the language around them.
Right.
But, you know, I think very strongly that my perspective has been that for South Asian men, it's a lot of desexualized parts. And for South Asian women, it's hypersexualized.
That is I 100% agree. Right. It's hypersexualized. And with South Asian men, you have, and this is a bit of a microcosm in the difference between men and women, it's just heightened. Whereas with men, if you're South Asian, you can look like all kinds of different types of man and have a career, especially like right now, you know, look at Cal Penn versus Manish Dayal. That's his name, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can fit the spectrum, but to be a South Asian woman, a lot of times you find the struggle that you have to be hot. You have to be sexy. Mm-hmm. I know of a couple actors who I get the, she's just not hot enough. She's just not sexy enough. And it's fine for one particular role. But when you hear it as all the time,
yeah.
And it's not just pretty, you know, it's not just, we got to be on television. It's, oh, they're pretty, but they're not sexy. This person has to be sexy. And I feel as if South Asian women are still more limited in that way of, okay, they need to be sexy.
I think in general, Asian women, South Asian, and then whatever we normally call Asian,
East Asian,
are like fetishized a lot.
Right.
And that's where I think a lot of it comes from.
Right.
Now, we still laugh at East Asians enough that you can be a not sexy Asian woman and be like Margaret Cho's funny and she can do the accent of her parents and that's funny to us. So, all right, cool. That slides. But I think I think it has something to do with the fact that they're fetishized probably.
Right. But it's happened before where you see people and they say, oh, well, there's this girl, she's Asian, South Asian, Asian, and she's quirky and kind of quirky looking, but maybe not funny. And so there's no work for her because it's just too hard.
Well, let's talk about how things are shifting. And you know, Gersh has been always really great about, you know, not being limited by what a breakdown will say, a casting breakdown will say. I know I don't know if that's written in policy or if that's just part of the culture, but I'm wondering, you know, you work with a lot of you must be in contact with a lot of other agencies. Is that becoming the norm now? Is that becoming, because I'm hoping that it is, but is that the way that all agencies are thinking?
When I talk to people at other agencies or other management companies, and first of all, I will say it's absolutely a part of the culture to be open-minded, to be creative. That's what's fun about our jobs, to be creative. So why would we limit ourselves? I think when I talk to other agencies and other management companies, the attitude about the shift in diversity, actually overall, I would say the attitude of the shift of shift in diversity, especially when you're in a room with like only white people, can be a little frightening and off-putting because there's an underlying almost resentment of, you know, that Deadline article that came out last year, the oh, well, I'm a white guy, a white person, and I used to get jobs and now I don't because of this push for diversity. And then they'll say something like, which is great, but, and I understand that it sucks to not work. It sucks to have a job and then suddenly you don't have a job anymore. That's got to be a rough transition where you figure, okay, how do I deal with this? But the problem was the pool was small and it was tailored to you. And now they've just opened up the pool. They're seeing more people and being more open-minded. So I feel that other agencies are trying to, they don't see actors kind of for who they are. They're just, okay, well, now that networks want diversity, we have to sign our diverse clients. Let's make a push for diversity. No more, you know,
it's still looking at them as commodities.
Yeah. I mean,
do they, it's all kind of, I would think they kind of look at all actors as commodities.
Yeah.
But it sounds like,
You'll never hear. I need more white guys on my list. You'll hear something like, "Well, I need an Indian person on my list. I need that," and that just feels so like, okay, great. So you can find anyone, and then you have an Indian person on your list. But what does that do for you? What does that do for the art of what we do?
That's what I was saying, why I was bringing up commodities, because they're not like actually excited about, say, someone, or they might not. They're just trying to fill their own quotas.
Right. I see what you're saying.
I don't know. I don't know how that point strikes to the larger conversation. It was just something I heard from it.
Let me ask you this. You said there is a business push for diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little more?
Sure. I think that what's great is, and this is the way that I feel that diversity will happen. What's great is there's been a diversity push from the top down. It's been mandated by studios. It's been mandated by networks, by producers, and not just with actors, writers, directors, diversity, including people who are trans, women, not just ethnic diversity, even sometimes just a different looks. They want a diverse looking cast in terms of body type, face, just a creative kind of pool rather than having everybody have a cookie cutter look. So
thank you, Shonda.
Exactly. Networks are realizing that, and we're talking about television because I'm talking about television, especially because the studios sort of have yet to keep up. Hello, Aloha and Exodus and Gods of Egypt are all of those other movies that thankfully didn't do well. So now it's, I think, starting to get the ball rolling. But with television, pilot season, it was mandated. It was, this character is Black, this character is Asian. But a lot of times what happens is they won't mandate this character is Black. It'll be, this character is not white.
Yeah, I know that happened with the one, I probably shouldn't say the name or the network, but one pilot, Latino comic got, and then his best friend, who he talks about in his act all the time, another Latino dude, but then in the TV show, he's suddenly just some old Black guy.
Yeah.
They changed his name and everything, and it was just like, all right, well, as long as he's not white.
Right. And what's interesting about that is, and this is where I'll turn the tables on you and ask you guys a little bit, and I think we talked about this last time, is I think that there is a debate within communities, you know, particularly communities of color, communities of people of color, but also could apply to women and things like that, are, okay, if some white guy has written a pilot script and the characters are Mike and Bob and they, you know, are best friends, and then you have open ethnicity and you have a Black guy and an Indian guy as best friends, you cast them, it's... A lot of people are like, that's great. I want to go out for parts that are written as white guys so that they're the better parts and then I can bring something to that. But then if your guys' characters are Mike and Bob and you're just talking the way white guys would, then isn't a little inauthentic to your experience as a South Asian person that influences you? That is it erasing and saying, okay, this Indian guy named Mike and this Black guy named Bob are best friends, but they don't talk like they, you know, like a South Indian guy and
well,
a
I think
South
that
Asian
guy. So I think that there's a few things to unpack there that I would talk about. One, there's the name, there's the language that you're referring to, and then there's like the content, right? So let's start with the language. I don't know what it means to talk like a South Asian. Like, I just think that's part of the issue.
You could address it in ways like, you have a mother that speaks to you in Hindi sometimes or whatever. There's a way to call to your...
Can I be honest with you? I don't ever feel a need to prove my South Asian-ness when I'm on TV because I am South Asian. I look brown and that makes it... There's a very clear identifying way for people to know. I do, though, where I do fight for it is the name. I do fight for that every time because I feel very strongly that I am South Asian. I'm not going to be seen not South Asian. I mean, I could, unless I was playing, Syrian or if I was playing, I mean, I got very much mistaken for Cuban a lot in Cuba. So I guess that's something, if I was playing Cuban, that would be another situation. But I think that there's like a concept of, you know, there's times when I think it's really powerful when I'm just a human who happens to be South Asian and we're not talking about it in the script. And, you know, one of my biggest arguments against the girls was, her argument was that I don't have any experience with those communities. Like, how can I write for them? Mm-hmm. And it's like, just write fucking humans and let them be played by someone who's not white. And you can understand that we have especially in America and especially at this point in time, My experience, if you blindfolded yourself and listened to me, you wouldn't know what ethnicity I was. You wouldn't know where I was. You would assume I was from America. You'd actually probably assume I was from New York.
Right.
And so, you know what I mean? So what does that mean?
Right.
You know, and I think that there are times when I'm like, that's the most powerful statement we can make. And then there are times when you do want it to address.
Right. I don't know why, but I haven't figured out how to word it before. Whatever reason, whenever people say, I happen to be, insert minority here, that really bothers. And I'm not saying you used it that way.
But that term,
it's like, you don't happen to be. Like, to me, right. It almost removes the pride from being who you are.
Right.
Okay, I think I hear what you're saying in the language of it.
Yeah.
That was not the intention. No, I get that.
And I'm not jumping on you.
No, but...
But I hear that language a lot, and I there's not a lot of times that language is something I jump on. You know that about me.
Yeah,
but that is like this thing that people say, like, it's with this certain air of righteousness. And I'm like, there's no righteousness in removing the pride from it. Now, and I'm not, like, maybe that's not how they're using it, but that's how it lands
it's
on
just,
me.
It's a way of separating people by saying that your entire identity is this thing. It's like, no, it's again the same reason that I have an issue with the 5 stereotypes that existed, at least when I counted them, of the South Asian men. Mm-hmm. It's probably different at this moment. But the fact that they were so limited was like, well, I'm more expansive than that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, well, your entire identity is that you're Indian, I'm like, no, that's a big part of my identity.
Right.
But I'm also, a committed service member. I'm also like, I love, you know, whatever are the other aspects of
what I do. And I just want to be cognizant of the fact that we don't want to go to the way of erasing it
I think
that the name is the biggest thing. Because
what's interesting is the one I shot this like pilot presentation or something like that, where I went in to play a character, had a white name. They liked me the best. I got the thing. I don't remember his name, but I remember thinking I didn't, because this character is so often like it was like this emasculated kind of like weak, I had to have no self-confidence, whatever, that you always see Indians playing. I was like, I want to keep the white name. They changed it to an Indian name for me, and I didn't raise my voice but I was like, I kind of want to keep the white name because I'm so sick of Indian dudes playing this guy.
Right.
I would rather play him as someone else and not. It was like a weird, there's a couple times I'm like, I don't want the Indian. Like, if you're going to play me the same thing you always portray Indians as, I'm good.
I think it was August Wilson who had said things like, I don't want black players playing white roles, I want people to write more roles for black actors. And
I agree with that.
But I think that there's a dichotomy because pilots are such the blueprint to a show. You can't possibly, they're so short, you have an entire series, you can't possibly develop and cast the entire thing. Sandra Oh, as Christina on Grey's Anatomy, it wasn't written that way. But you cast her because the pilot was just that sliver of the character.
Sure, you have an opportunity to build that in.
Yeah, exactly.
You build that in that she's Korean. She was adopted. The entire life story that made sense.
Right.
They gave her a last name, Christina Yang. Like,
yeah, I'm with that.
That makes sense to me because it was a part of her story, but it wasn't, she's the Korean doctor. It's not the limiting thing that you're talking about. I just want to make sure that and Kerry Washington talked about that too, where she's like, I don't want people to see me as not black, but I don't want my blackness to be the only part of me. It's the balance.
And I think that that's one of the like privileges of whiteness, is that you never have to paint that line. And
you
like,
guys figured that out about us?
It's just like, you don't have to... You don't ever have to. The neutrality allows for an expansiveness.
Whiteness is the default.
Yeah.
What's interesting as a comic is it's almost tougher in a sense that, like, good friend of mine is a comedian, Andrew Schultz, white dude. He's always like, I don't know what to open with. And for me, it's like, I open with the fact that I'm Indian. It's just what you do. You kind of address the thing. You don't see a lot of Indian comics. Here's one. Open with that. You almost have to. Because people don't see it that often.
Right.
But it's like, all right, well, took care of that. Never have to worry about what I open with anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And for a white comic, it's like, how do I make these people know me?
Right.
For a stand-up where it's about you, it's like, how do I make these people know that I'm different than every other white dude you see? If you want to sit down and listen to me for an hour, I guess. But you got to sit down and listen for the hour.
Right. Interesting.
I want to move away a little bit from the industry too, one of the other reasons we're interested to talk with you is that you are married to a South Asian man. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious about how that developed, whether there was, I guess the biggest thing to be curious about is, you know, we had recently on a podcast with a Puerto Rican woman who was married to a Pakistani gentleman, and that there was a lot of cultural differences that were really hard to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
You are successfully married and have been for some time. And so I'd just be curious to hear your experience with the cultural differences, whether that was tough.
Sure. Don't ever leave books on the floor. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
The shoes are never on in the house. You have to, and it's not just me, that's fine by me, but it's when your family comes to town or when people come in and I'm not watching that the shoes are taken off. Not good. I just realized I had my shoes on. I'm like, wow, I'm usually pretty good about this.
Well, this is a back house in the desert of LA. It's a concrete floor.
Those little things were the only things where it's like, why would you leave those books on the floor? Oh, because I'm just getting them out of the way. But there haven't been any real cultural differences that have resulted in conflict. I'll say that.
Had you dated many South Asians before?
No. I mean, I hadn't dated many people before, to be honest. Right. I met him when I was pretty young. So I hadn't dated anybody South Asian. I'd only really dated white guys. And again, kind of because I hadn't really dated very many people. He was the first kind of real relationship that I had been in. That's what it was about that.
But you had mentioned last time you are Swedish in ethnic background.
Yeah.
But you and your mom came here to the country, right?
Or what? Well, was no. So my mom's family, my mom's grandmother and grandfather on both sides of the family, they were all Swedish immigrants. So
okay.
Her parents were first generation, she's second generation. So there's definitely I definitely know of stories of the immigrant story and how that's influenced me in terms of culture, but in terms of how am I Swedish, I've never been to Sweden. I don't know the language. That is, that part of my culture is not really there.
So you don't particularly identify?
No.
You would, mm-hmm. Would you call yourself simply American?
Yeah. I would call myself a white American and what that entails.
A true American.
all American. Back to the industry thing. 5 years ago, I was an assistant and I got in a fight with a casting director because all American meant white, and she decided to yell at me about. And I was so offended and so mad. And then my boss was like, why? What, all American means white. And I don't think that they'd get away with that now. I just don't. But I'm happy I fought that fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know it didn't mean white anymore. I thought that still meant white.
Yeah, to me,
it's
white.
It's still kind of code, but I think that that all American can mean wholesome. You're on the cover of a brochure, but maybe, you know, all American can be, okay, are you seen at a barbecue? But even if that's not true, even if it is code for white, I don't accept that. I hate that.
Tell you
what,
there ain't going to be a lot of Hindus in no barbecue.
There'll be a lot of Indians, though.
Not a lot of Hindus. We're going to be grilling up garden burgers.
Talk to us about family and integrating a family and stuff. And how was that, you know, I mean, there must have been stuff to learn.
Yeah.
And how that all.
So I'll talk a little bit about, first of all, the question that most people ask, which may be common, maybe not, but everyone asked, oh, were his parents okay with it? And yes, a lot of his my husband's cousins are married to white people. His parents were very welcoming of me, very accepting. And so that was never really a problem. I did have to navigate, again, little challenges that seemed like big challenges. So, you know, for my husband, it was important to have an Indian wedding. Great.
Right.
I
there
said,
goes six
okay.
figures.
Right. How'd you know? No, I'm just kidding. And I said, okay, great. And he was open to, we could have an Indian wedding and a Western wedding, but I'm not very religious. I wasn't really raised with a religion or a Christian, and I'm not a Christian, so I didn't want to, there wasn't a religious part of me that wanted to have the Christian ceremony. And I said, no, we have a wedding ceremony. I will feel married and we'll do the wedding ceremony. So I was accepting of that. I did wear a white dress to the reception because I'm a girl and I wanted a dress.
I respect that.
And, but I...
Not that you're asking for my respect.
I'm always asking for your respect. You should know that. But then you get to the part of, okay, how do I plan a wedding? And what is an Indian wedding? Right. Oh, well, there are like 8 different kinds. You know, well, there's a South Indian wedding and there's a North Indian wedding. And then there's a Gujarati wedding and they all have different things and every Indian wedding is totally different.
And they're all drunk.
And I said, okay. And then the first wedding I went to was, you know, 2 years before we got engaged. I was like, remember her wedding? Well, kind of, but not enough to plan it. And are we going to do the same thing? The only thing that I remember from that wedding, which was true at our wedding, was because it'll last for an hour and a half. And all of the Indian people are up and talking and they're talking to everybody else. And the white people are just sitting there and they're quiet and they're like focused. And it was like for an hour and a half.
Right.
And
the Indians are like, funny the way that like Western folk, when they come to Indian weddings, really pay attention to the mandap and the ceremony. And all of us are just like, Where's the food?
I went to a 9-hour wedding in Bangalore, India. Man. And this was when we had just gotten engaged. So I was one step short of taking notes. And I'm sitting there and, you know, my husband's like, okay, well, they're serving food. I'm like, they're serving food. It's still going on. No. Everyone's going. Their brothers are down having food.
Right.
Okay. And it was a lot. They were taking down the decorations outside and the wedding was still going on.
You went to India. Was that your first time going to India?
That time was my first time. I've been to India twice.
In total?
Yeah.
What is your experience when you go to India? And what is your experience going to India as married to a South Asian man? Like, what is your experience?
So my experience going to India the first time. So we went to India when we first got engaged. And I went to India a second time after we first got married. And we had a party there. My experience the first time was wonderful, but it was also overwhelming because I had just gotten engaged and I'm meeting the entire family. We're also doing a tour of India.
Wow.
And P.S. I have to buy all of my wedding supplies because it's way cheaper in India than out here. And why you're in India, so just buy them here. Okay, wow. So I have to find a sari. I have to buy saris for all of my bridesmaids. Am I going to have bridesmaids? Who are they going to be? You know, that was very overwhelming for me because I didn't even know. And then I find out that there's a difference between a South Indian sari and a North Indian sari. Well,
is there?
Yeah, apparently.
I don't know.
I can show you. And I'm like, well, if I got a North Indian sari, is that bad? How bad is that?
So your husband's South Indian?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And
you had no guide? I mean, you were there. None of your family was there this trip, so it was just you.
No.
Did the family...
Yeah, they helped. I had cousins who helped me pick out the bridesmaids' saris. You know, my mother-in-law was very helpful, but it was also just a little bit, you know, I felt I was in charge of planning this wedding, and I wasn't sure what I was planning. You know, okay, what supplies do I need? How is this going to run? And a lot of it was, okay, we just kind of go with the flow. You don't have to worry so much. But I knew with a Western wedding, okay, walk you down the aisle, say your vows, ring, ring.
Boring, wow. Boring, boring.
Right? Exactly. Boring and short.
But I'm curious as to, you know, at that point when you went to India, you had been with your partner for how long at that point?
We had been together seriously for 2 years.
2 years, but you've known him for...
Yeah, we've known each other for a long time, for probably... 6 years at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
So
5 years.
When you went to India, I mean, I'm fascinated by whether there was a part of the India that you fell in love with as well, or if that was just icing on the cake. I'm curious. Maybe you can't speak to that.
Right.
When thinking about your partner, I'm obviously single.
I think there are a couple things there. First of all, I'm all about family. Family's very important to me. Cool. I think one of the reasons that I am with an a South Asian man, an Indian man, is because family values and family community, and right. it takes a village type of mentality. And when you get married, you marry the families. That's kind of what I grew up with. I'm close to a lot of my distant cousins, like third cousins, fourth cousins. So I think that concept of family was what drew everyone to me. So meeting my husband's grandmother, who now is 96 years old wow. and still sharp as a tack,
right.
who she's talking and I'm asking her for wedding advice, and she was saying how she was putting on her sari, and then she tells me, you know, and then, you know, she tells me all about her life and what it must have been like for her. And it was fascinating to me. So the part about India that I think really resonated with me, I should also tell you this, my husband's parents live in India.
Oh, wow.
So they came here, immigrated here, raised his family, and moved back.
Wow.
Which is rare. Yeah.
It's what every Indian parent says they're going to do.
Right. They did it, and they volunteer, and they've retired. So spending time with my husband's parents and getting to know them as a part of the whole family thing, that's the part about India that really spoke to me, was just, okay, the culture is within the family. And that to me is where I feel, okay, I can change my last name, have an Indian wedding, and be a part of this culture because I've been welcomed in by the family.
There's two things I'm curious about. One, you're probably pretty insulated with that first trip with amongst family and amongst family. Mm-hmm. But you also said there was a tour of India. I'm curious where... What was your experience just walking around India as a white woman?
So the people would kind of stare at me. There would be pointing. There was one time we went to this park/zoo type of thing, and there were a group of children, and they wanted to take my picture.
Mm-hmm.
They were pointing there, and they said, "Hey, take a picture with us. Take a picture." And I'm, you know, a narcissist, so of course I sit down and I take a picture, and I'm okay. And but it was a weird feeling because everyone also was saying how they're saying, "Oh my God, your skin, it's so beautiful." And I'm also, you know, I'm a girl, I'm insecure. So I'm like, "Oh my God, I feel so pretty and I feel so great." And it's like, no, not because I'm white, but there was a whiteness equaling beautiful thing that I
definitely you were able to pick up on that.
Felt. Oh, yeah, in a really uncomfortable way.
Were you schooled to that? Did your husband tell you about that? Or was it just something you automatically noticed inherently?
I knew about that. I knew about the dark skin being bad, fair being important. Right. I don't remember if he told me about it or if I just knew about it because I know about the culture. Okay. So it
really worked out well for me.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm light skinned. Oh, and as a kid, I was a monster. I was hideous. But I went to India. They thought I was adorable just because I was light-skinned. I had white people eyes.
Yeah.
It's great.
Wow. Good job.
I know why white people here are so reluctant to let it go. You know what I mean? Right. I get it, I guess. I get it.
So you don't need any Fair and Lovely or anything?
No.
Yeah.
I see you, though. I peep game. Mm-hmm.
There, aside from just the family, though, it sounded like there were aspects of the culture that you really resonated with that felt almost at home with you in some ways.
And it's weird because that part I can't explain. And maybe because it's spending so much time around like a Hindu philosophy, it was like maybe I was Indian in another life or something and I came back to that, but which I'm starting to come around to in terms of a religion, or religious belief rather. But it just felt like, okay, this fits for me. And I think when I was struggling with the planning and the stress of planning a wedding in general, and I was talking to my friend, I was just, oh my God, this would have been so much easier if I fought for a Western wedding and if it wasn't important. And my friend had to tell me, okay, you've always been in love with culture, whether it's coming to temple with me or living in Spain for 3 weeks, you've wanted to have a rich experience, a rich culture. And now I kind of feel that I've been welcomed into experiencing a rich culture without being appropriative. So that's been really wonderful for me. And I try to kind of grasp that, essentially.
We'll close with this topic, religion and children.
Children, I was going to say children. Yeah.
No, let's combine the two.
Yeah. Okay.
How do you feel about that?
I'm into it.
Okay.
So you are, it sounds like you're in a process of becoming Hindu? Is that, or well, what was that? I don't know.
I'll just say that. I mean, my husband's family are definitely more spiritual than they are religious in terms of religious beliefs.
Okay.
And I would say I've always identified as agnostic. That's kind of been where I go to. But
it's a comfy place.
Yeah. It's a comfy face. A comfy space of vagueness,
right?
Yeah.
With which to hang out.
And I don't mean to be one of those people. Well, I'm spiritual, but not religious. It's a cop out. I'm just gonna say I'm agnostic. However, in living with someone whose Hinduism is very important to him as a way of life, I can't help but kind of be attracted to that, appreciate that, and in anticipation of a question, yeah, my kids will be raised Hindu.
Well, do you guys go to temple? How does your Hinduism? I was curious of people. Hinduism is such a amorphous religion.
Right.
It's
and,
not
and
codified
I when
that
you
well.
Had the U.S. I can't remember.
Dr. Vernon
Dr.
Soni.
Soni. He
oh,
was so great.
How dare you forget his name? How dare you?
I know. I'm so sorry. He was
you
so
You should
wonderful.
Be. He's an incredible person.
he's not listening right now.
Very, very kind eyes.
You're going to send this to him.
He does have kind eyes.
Oh, you don't think I noticed? You don't think that was a real compliment? I noticed.
Oh, God.
Anyway, I remember listening to a lot of that as the amorphous religion and thinking, okay, now I understand it because I still don't know a lot about it. I'm not as educated as I could be or should be.
Neither am I.
That, you know? Yeah, but I from the lifestyle choices and the conversations and
but it's not like you guys are rocking temple every Thursday.
No,
it's not like
no,
you're doing, you know, cover shots.
Nope.
Or right.
No.
That stuff has not.
No.
Okay. Mm-mm. So it's more about teaching. It's almost the cultural lifestyle ways of
yeah.
life stuff that you want to pass along
right.
to children.
Your husband's Hinduism.
Is there stuff of your that of your Swedish or that you feel.
I mean, there's stuff.
Well, let's talk about that though.
They're not getting
furniture
from any old furniture store. I'll tell you that much.
But let's because that's what's you know you're third generation American on your mother's side.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're. I don't know about your father.
German and mostly German,
but
immigrated Native American.
Generation wise, was he there longer in America or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're some generation, but let's just focus on the Swedish side. You're third generation, and you're at a point where you don't. You don't really identify with it any longer.
Right.
Is there a way to identify what happened between those two generations and you?
I mean, I think a lot of it happened, but I think that it happened kind of the way that a lot of immigrant stories happen, in that my grandmother was, you know, it was a different time, and I believe that she and my grandfather were kind of taught to assimilate, and that
right.
was it.
Right.
You know, she didn't know Swedish, and I remember asking her, "Do you speak Swedish?" And she said, "I can understand it completely, and I can't speak a word."
Mm.
And I told her when I was six at the time that that made no sense and that was impossible. So, I think it
is impossible. It's if you understand it, you can speak it. You just have a block that
right.
you can't.
Right.
It's a psychological block.
It's different parts. It's actually different parts of the brain.
Is it?
Yeah, it's different parts of the brain.
Man, I had such a strong point.
I'm telling you,
I just got shot down.
I felt bad for you.
Oh man,
you pulled the rug out from under you.
I just got bodied so bad, man. That was,
it's true. You'll find this in people whose parents speak a language and the kids are not asked to respond. They don't. It's more than a block. It's about being asked. You have to practice that muscle.
Right.
Hmm.
So it's weird because you think, of course, you can speak it, but
right.
it's a different, the block is the different part of the brain and the muscle not being exercised. I'm obsessed with languages.
So do you guys, are you going to learn?
Oh, how do?
You know.
Yes, I'm out of it. Cool.
Yeah, we don't know what you just said.
Okay.
We speak.
I'm just trying
Hindi.
To, if there are any Gunadigas here, maybe you won't be able to correct me, but yeah, I've been working on learning the
They'll
language
tweet
for
at
a long
us.
Time.
She actually has a great ear. We talked about this the last interview. She has probably a better ear for languages than either one of us.
Thanks,
so her enunciation, her pronunciation is always pretty good.
I work on it. But that was the other thing. So when I go to India and you're meeting the parents, I wanted some insurance. I hope that they like me, that they think that I'm legit. So I learned some kind of phrases to try and impress them. And the bar is set so, so low. for me.
Amazing.
Like the fact that I said yes in Canada, it's, I mean, oh my God, that's incredible. Look at her. Why don't you speak as well as she does? And they're like, I do, by the way. This is a white girl who memorized three phrases, but you know, yeah. Don't tell anybody. And so I really like languages, and I knew that learning the language and making sure that the language is passed down to our kids, that's really important to me, because I know you guys talk about the language culture and things like that. My thing was, I was in North India and I didn't know any Hindi, and I was like, I should have learned the other language.
It's really interesting to, we don't even have to ask the questions. Yeah. She's already like, I know what question you're going to ask.
She married the podcast.
We've become that predictable.
No, man, I just like to talk about myself. It's true.
Well, we've come to the closing of our time, and I'm not going to put your Twitter on blast unless you want to.
No, I don't even check my Twitter.
There
so.
You go.
It's a good idea.
But brown folk, you know, you got a fan, you got a supporter, an ally is the word I was looking for over at Gersh. Luis Quechavalla. You're just going to get an outpouring of headshots and resumes of all the brown folk.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
Got you, girl. Because you don't have enough on your plate right now. No, but seriously, it's always interesting to hear other perspectives. You know, sometimes when we talk about these things in a vacuum, having someone that's on the other right. side that can either check us or, you know, support what we're saying is really fascinating. And then, you know, it's a unique experience to be in an interracial relationship. And
yeah.
We got an example of one that didn't work out so well. And it's lovely to hear the example of one that is working out mm-hmm. in a beautiful way. And again, it seems like just being on the same page and having that communication of what you want and shared values seems right. to be, like, it seemed like there was a...
I guess I'll sort of end with this.
End, please, yeah.
For me, I understand that the loss of culture, especially probably because it happened to me, is not great. That one of the concerns about, you know, being... You know, if you are South Asian and you want to marry, you are concerned about not marrying another South Asian is a loss of culture. Okay, if I marry a white person, we have a half white kid, a half South Asian kid, and then they marry another white person, then that's it. What do they have? That's not, you know, that culture doesn't live on here. And that's why if you're Jew, I mean, it's not just South Asians who are worried about sure. intermarriage. If you're Jewish, it's like, okay, well, if you raise your kids Jewish, I mean, this happens everywhere. And I knew that. And so I said, okay, this is going to be a priority to kind of preserve the culture, because I knew that it was important to my husband.
Beautiful.
Aw.
Well, thank you, Luis, for coming back.
Thank you.
And this time we'll actually be able to drop this for y'all to listen
Thanks
to.
For having me.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
You guys know what we're about to say, so we're not going to say it.
I'm not going to say it. I've had enough.
Rate the podcast. Review the podcast.
What else?
I just dropped that mic. Do you hear
me? You got to subscribe to the podcast,
oh,
too,
I'm sorry.
Luis.
I'm sorry. I was too busy dropping this mic.
But we're going to come back at you all with another dope episode next week. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And we'll catch you then.
God bless.